employment. This is a panel session. We're going to run right up until lunch. I'm InfoWorld Senior Contributing Editor Paul Venezia. And the focus of this discussion is basically from the ground up. This is starting with an idea and taking that all the way through to deployment and implementation. We've got a good panel here today, and also I should actually make a note now that if you're looking for the vendor roundtable at the round the corner in the ballroom 3. Yes. So, with no further ado, we'll run down the list and let my panelists introduce themselves. So, Chris.
Welcome, everyone. Appreciate you attending the session here today. I'm Chris Barclay. I'm product management at Birchwire, and get pretty involved in a lot of the deployments that our customers and partners have. Actually learn a little bit about your environments and the sorts of issues you're having and challenges you're facing. So I've been at Birchwire for past 2.5 years. Before that, I worked in various other companies in the enterprise data center space, and always enjoy hearing about the sorts of activities that you're engaged in. I think virtualization is one of those that is pretty transformative, as we've heard from the previous speakers, and look forward to the dialogue with them.
Good morning, my name is Vincent Littlecombe. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for Transplace. We are a third-party logistics provider. We move about $3 billion worth of freight annually in a software as a service model. We just recently completed a full transformation to virtualization over about 6 months.
I'm Adam Gray. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for NovaCoast. And we're an IT professional services and product development company with people in 17 states throughout the U.S. And one of our main specialties and one of the things we do often is help environments get converted to virtualized environments and help them set up proper management and monitoring systems.
Hi, my name is Matt Briggy. I'm the systems engineer or systems architect for the SimQuest Group. We're a consultancy based out of Dover, New England. Mostly doing business technology stuff within the small medium business segment. Most of our business recently has been, well, probably within the past 2 years, something involved in virtualization related, whether it's server virtualization or desktop virtualization. So.
I'm Gregory Smith. I'm with T-Systems North America. T-Systems is part of the Deutsche Telekom Group, so we're a very large 56,000 global service provider, as well as internal IT shop for Deutsche Telekom. I'm responsible for our Dynamic Services, which is a complete integrated virtualized platform for deploying enterprise applications. And here to talk a little bit about some of the interesting challenges that we've had getting from where we were to where we are today.
Good. Thanks, guys. Well, to kick things off, everything that we're going to talk about here starts with the kernel of the place where we want to be. The reasons for virtualizing infrastructure are many and varied. We're going to assume that we've already made the decision, obviously, to go in that direction, but we may not have the any idea of where to start. And Matt, I think I'm going to start with you here because you run into this on probably a weekly basis. When you're presented with a client or an infrastructure that currently exists in physical form, where do you start? What's the first thing that hits the table when you sit down?
Well, I think the tendency for a lot of people is to figure out, to kind of jump ahead of things and say, we're going to virtualize and we like this software package and we're going to use digital servers. But I think probably the first thing you really have to do is sit down and look at your current server architecture and figure out what it's doing. In the non-virtualized way of doing things, you would never spend $5,000 or $6,000 or $10,000 to buy a server for one tiny little application. You just wouldn't do that. So pretty much everybody who has a virtualized, a lot of people who have in this room, have servers that have 3, 4, 5 whatever applications on them, just because they're little and really didn't deserve their own machine. So really the first thing you have to do is kind of separate, in your mind, separate the applications you have from the hardware that are on. I think a lot of people look at a lot of the physical to virtual migration tools that they have that are out there and say, well, we can take all these, 20 or 200 or however many servers and port them over exactly where they are and put them into a virtualized environment. And that will work. But to really get the benefit of one of the benefits of virtualization, you can really split those loads up. And all you have to do is buy a server license for 2003 Windows-based server or split those things up into their own applications so you can reduce cross dependencies. So really the first thing I try to get our clients to do is to look at their applications more than their servers and really kind of plan out the cross dependencies between them and split them up. And that's really the first thing you do is figure out what you have, what depends upon what, and split things up. And so the result of that is a lot of times after you're done virtualizing, if you had, again, 20 or 200 servers to start with, you may have 30 or maybe 300 virtual machines afterward as a result of splitting that up. It will be much more efficient if you have to patch one server or one application, you're not going to affect a bunch of other ones at the same time. So that sort of thinking is the first thing you have to do before you even before you can really pick a platform or anything like that, is figure out what you're going to have afterward. And it's short-sighted to just look at taking this hardware and getting rid of it and just moving those loads. If you've already done that, if you've already got that in hardware environment, then kudos to you, but most people don't. So.
Adam, is that job with your experiences?
Yeah, we actually looked quite a bit at starting with the application side. So what are they trying to virtualize? With us internally, we took our heaviest workloads and did those last. Mail servers are often difficult to virtualize because we get a lot of traffic, lots of small packets, lots of I/O. That was hard. So we took our mail server, we took our mail server systems, which is the telephony systems, things with specialized hardware, all of those got pushed out of scope. And when we go to environments, that's sort of the first thing we want to push out of scope are heavily used databases, things that are going to require a lot of planning around migration or that affect too much of the enterprise. Anytime you start looking at that, you want to push those out of scope to start. And after that, it was review the systems architectures. What made the best case for taking virtualization? What operating systems, what applications, what stacks? What were the capabilities of the administration staff? Could they run this infrastructure as we put it in? Could they understand that powering off a physical machine could affect 10, 20, 30, 50 virtual machines? And run that properly. You find that once you break all these pieces out, you now have to take on different managements.
Mm-hmm. And Vincent, your recently completed migration. How did you use that? The basic idea you used to get into it?
Well, some of the things that I would encourage you to think about would be, what is the type of server? Is it just an engine, or does it manage state as well? So if it's just an engine, it's fairly simple. Look at your software licensing model as well. As we went to virtualization, I agree with what Matt said. You start going with, in our case, we deliberately chose to go with very fine-grained virtual servers. We would only put a single application on a virtual server. We're very large users of VEA's WebLogic. So what we would do, we would only put a single application into a single instance of WebLogic. We would only put that on its own server. What that then makes you look at is, what's that going to do with your software licensing? So when we spoke with VEA, they tried to get us to go with their new version that is basically runs directly on a hypervisor. The problem with that is, well, number one, it doesn't run on the latest version of WebLogic. Number two, then you have to pay by virtual machine. So what we did was, those of you that deal with software vendors out there are probably in the same position, where the software licensing model is always dictating the architecture, and that's simply a fact of life. I don't like it, but I have to live with it. So what we did was, we created a separate VM virtual cluster just for WebLogic applications, so that I could go to VEA and say, I'm going to pay for 6 servers with however many processes they have on it. I'll run all my WebLogic stuff on these 6 servers, and then that way I don't have to get into problems with metering or anything like that. So definitely keep one eye on what are your software vendors going to do to you, because they come knocking at the door with big smiles when you go to virtualization. Second thing is, I would also understand what it's going to do from a storage point of view. Quite frankly, we did this very quickly. We didn't think it through quite as much as one might want to. We had certain reasons for that. But we were surprised by the amount of network appliance time I looked again, we consumed 4 terabytes of storage. And that's a lot of money, even for today's storage costs. So software licensing, definitely. Understanding the storage, plan for how you use your storage, because that's one of the hardest things to change after you're done.
And Chris, when people approach Virtual Iron with this in mind, do you have like a standard set of questions or dependencies that you need to go through first before you move anywhere beyond start?
Yeah, no, I would say the planning, kind of echoing the previous panelists, is one of the most critical pieces of the puzzle. So thinking through what are your overall objectives to your virtualization effort, not just in the near term, but also long term, to make sure that you're thinking through the dynamics of the architecture as it scales. We certainly know that a number of our R's use consolidation planning tools that are out there like Placement, and definitely advise you to take a look at the sorts of workloads you're thinking about virtualizing. And I think 3 types of workloads kind of make natural fits with your early virtualization efforts, kind of looking through, so to speak. Those that are kind of low utilization of the physical world. Secondly, are things that are very dynamic, so dev test environments. And the last is kind of HA types of environments. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of mean time to failure, mean time to repair that you know, you'd like to actually get better, but aren't necessarily clustered today because physical server clustering is painful. So look at those as other good natural virtualization candidates. And I think just to echo some of the other panelists, you know, looking at kind of the storage architecture and kind of your backup, your HA, your DR strategies, how this all plays into it, making sure you have a very simple and elegant solution that's going to carry you forward, not just the next 6 to 12 months, but you know, for the next 2 years.
So if we're starting from the point of view that we really need to, I mean, ideally in a perfect world, everybody knows every moving part of their infrastructure, they know all their licensing costs, they know exactly how hard every server is working. In the real world, not so much. So there are tools out there that that can assist with that, and I'll just throw this one up in the air. What do you guys use? What, I mean, what really became the tool of choice for determining what a loaded physical infrastructure was?
We use a couple things. First, we're mostly a Linux shop internally. We've got essentially, I think we're down to 1 Windows server internally, and it's just a control BlackBerry. So for us, congratulations. It was a long road, a lot of planning, but we, you know, whittled it down, and we're there. So for us, my staff was comfortable on the Linux side, so we ended up using a couple of tools. I mean, some of the standard standby stuff, of, you know, loading up top, just taking a look at stuff. You know, the stuff you knew was going to be loading, you make sure there wasn't out there. Higher end stuff, obviously, we were looking at certain more enterprise monitoring tools. We landed over the past year on Zen OSS.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nice small startup, good solid code base, great monitoring. You know, we've been using that internally, and we think that it provides us enough flexibility and enough monitoring capabilities from a performance perspective to not only look at the virtual machines, but also look at the physical hardware. On the actual VM management, we use a product called OrchestraTor from Novell.
It's a tough thing to actually pick one that will work for everybody. I think having worked mostly in the small and medium business side, there's a definite propensity to not think you need a tool to do this. The problem with that is that you can't be working with Windows or Linux, Fire.com or, you know, Turkmon, and looking at the performance of the machine. That does tell you how busy that machine is.
At that point in time,
sure. And even if you run Turkmon for a month and average 5 minutes and go back and look at the numbers, that'll still tell you how busy that machine is and give you an accurate idea of that. The problem is that it'll only really tell you how busy that little microcosm is. And that server might be, you know, a dual proc box that's 3 years old, and another server sitting next to it might be a new gateway box. And that one might be running 2%, the older one's running 10. How do you actually relate that? And you can do that, you know, you can sit down with Excel and dump all the numbers into it and find some way to equalize that out. That's what a lot of those tools do. Given my company's a VMware partner, VMware Capacity Planner is what we end up using most frequently for Obviously, they'll exchange, again, talking about, you know, a simple Windows environment, exchange will be one of the ones we keep an eye on, especially in terms of storage, you know. It's really, I mean, the choice is really going to be one that's based on how big your environment is. You've got, you know, 20 machines, or you're going to end up with 20 VMs, because you may not actually need a tool for that. If you're talking about more than that, you really probably ought to get something, otherwise you're going to overlook something. But there are obviously, but LeoStream also has a, you know, a standalone product, also has a component for that. So.
Yeah, tools is still, I think it's still a tough problem. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better. I think people are realizing and seeing the vendors respond to it. But, you know, from our standpoint, from a large enterprise, both internally for managing our costs and how we manage things, as well delivering services out to customers, we've got to know all of this, right? We have very high costs. We're trying to run on margin. Plus, we need to roll up reporting. And moreover, you know, from a virtualization standpoint, we have the same, you know, heterogeneous problem that was talked about earlier in the keynotes, right? So we have, you know, various Unix, Linux, Windows, and so forth. So we can't rely on one tool to pull a lot of that stuff up. So part of, from our standpoint, is really look at, you know, what are the business drivers, what kind of optimization do we need to do, you know, look at it more from an operations business efficiency standpoint, figure out what it is we need to do, and then we kind of dive down and say, okay, this tool covers this area. So like with, you know, virtual center in areas of VMware Windows, we say, hey, okay, there's a lot of nice tools here. You know, we might be leveraging some software, some of the large enterprise, you know, Tivoli, BMC on the application layer. So there's all these islands of tools that we have to sort of wrap up, some of them we had to write on our own, and to roll that up so we could accomplish the goals that we needed to do. I think that's still largely the case. We'll probably be faced with that for a while, although, again, I think tool vendors are responding to that. So it depends a little bit on what your goals are and kind of get the planning questions beginning. You know, sort of, everybody has islands of tools and they make certain decisions about how what they want to use virtualization for, but the key is to step back and say, well, you know, where are you going, right? What are you trying to accomplish, and there are short-term and long-term pieces to that, and those goals are going to drive, you know, what are you going to go after first, what's low-hanging fruit, what kind of tools. I think that's sort of, you know, down the decision chain behind, you know, where you're trying to go.
I think that all the data collection is really only half the problem, maybe about a quarter of the work. The other piece you need to think about is how these workloads actually run in the virtualization environments you're looking at. And I think that, you know, there's some tools out there to help you with that as well, things like MLC, Consolidate, VMware, VMware, that help, you know, really analyze what different workloads look like in virtual environments. And I think one of the things I hear people kind of making a common mistake is running kind of the wrong types of workload assessment tools in virtual environments. The point is not to see, you know, how much throughput you can actually crank through a VM. You want to have a representative sampling of the actual workloads you're putting in virtual environments. And I think that's what Consolidate, for example, does a really good job at. So not only do you kind of need to, you know, profile your workloads, which is kind of the collection piece that we've been talking about, but also how do those workloads actually run in the environments? How do you consolidate? What's the best kind of workload mix per server?
I think as an anecdote, and, you know, serving as a warning to others, that there is also a time frame element to this. You can watch your infrastructure for 3 weeks and get a good idea about what that infrastructure is doing in those 3 weeks, and make like a planning based on that. In a real life scenario, I know of one instance where that was actually done, and the goal was to take all of the machines that didn't seem to be doing much of anything, collapse them onto one server, because, you know, we'll be able to shut off 5-6 boxes that are running at 2-3% utilization on this 3 week period. And they went ahead and did that, and everything was running great until the end of the month. The billing cycle came up, and there were 4 boxes that they had, that did nothing during the month, but all of a sudden had to do batch processing for 4 hours, all nailed that box at the same time, and all of a sudden there's no revenue coming in because of that. So you really need to get a handle on when these things happen in a chronological time frame, not just, you know, okay, well, for 2 weeks it did nothing, but the next 2 weeks it might do an awful lot more.
Yeah, I'd say 30 days is probably the minimum you would want to look at that, regardless of what you're doing, if not more than that.
And it's good to have, you know, back to the application view, right? It's easy to take an infrastructure view, and, you know, you can read that reality, what has to happen over time, and quarter, year end, or seasonal.
So I think you focus the application layer from a starting point to deal with it both up as a business on, you know, on SLA requirements, DR and so forth, business continuity is down in the infrastructure, then I think you can avoid some of that when you say, okay, sponsor your application X, what is your profile? What does that look like? When do you need what? So that the IT department can service that in an appropriate way. And that may mean just collapsing down on a couple of servers for a good part of the year, and then knowing you can have to pull it back out as a normal operation for any quarter.
The management tools also need to be smart enough to detect workloads and move them in appropriate timeframes. So we've got a shop we've been working with for a while that hosts some large sports sites that only come up once a year. And the rest of the year they've got 3,000 machines that sit pretty idle and they do some other things with them. But during that time, they have virtual machines spread among a small number, and as the traffic ramps up through the weeks and up to the couple weeks events, they have to spread back out on a larger number of machines. Mm-hmm. So management tools have to be able to detect the workload, take that workload and say, gee, I know there's more load here. I need to be able to spin up a new VM to load up on a new piece of hardware for either web services or even things that are state, you know, database services, things like that, to be able to continue to grow that grid out as needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure the Patriots 19.0.com site.
Yeah.
Mike, you don't look like Pat's fans of it. All right, so taking that as a necessary first step, I usually like to consider this as being more than just, it's an opportunity to do more than just plan for virtualization. This is an opportunity to do spring cleaning. And it's a perfect example that you can take to various business units and say, look, you know, you've had a good run of it, you have 6-8 servers here. We're doing this initiative, this is going to happen, so we're gonna clean some of this stuff out, we're gonna do these upgrades, we're just gonna basically reinvent our data center, but we don't have to do it in such a way that we have to take the whole piece and do it once. We can do it piecemeal and pull things across. Hopefully, the idea is that on the other side, you wind up with like a much cleaner infrastructure. It's a good, like I said, it's a good example. To do spring cleaning. So assuming that we have our baseline, we have a good idea of what we are going to virtualize, at least to begin with, perhaps exempting some of the bigger boxes and mail servers and things like that you might not want to throw into the fire just yet. What's the next step? What's after that? We know what we want to do, we know how we're going to do it, but what exactly, what do we buy? What do we look for in a server? What do we, we do blades? Do we do one use disk storage? You know, those are just enormous questions at this point. So, Matt, I'll toss you a hypothetical. If I'm looking at virtualizing 50 servers, and you can make up your own loads or whatever, but what's the first thing you do there?
Well, I think the software for the virtualization platform, Virtual Iron or VMware or whatever. That's really probably the first thing you have to figure out, because those softwares are going to have hardware compatibility lists that you need to assess out to figure out what hardware you're going to be able to use. Similarly, from there, you figure out the platform, then the type of server you're going to use, which may be influenced by the type of storage you use, specifically when you're talking about blades. So if you're bringing in blades and you need to, say, have ISCSI storage, then you have an interesting problem there to sort out in terms of whether you use software ISCSI or not. So they're kind of interconnected, but I think really the first thing is probably the virtualization platform, that decision can be complicated or can be simple depending upon what your environment looks like, what your people look like. It's probably one of the biggest things that can play into that. However, what your environment looks like will play into that a lot. So if you're sitting there with a whole ton of Linux boxes, then some type of parallel virtualization may work very well for you. Where if you're sitting there with a whole ton of Linux boxes, it's not, or probably isn't. So that's something we could probably sit up here for a couple of hours and hash out, if VMware is better than virtual iron, this will cost more and this will cost less. But that's really a question that you shouldn't run past figured out what virtualization platform you're going to use. Probably with storage is the next thing we'll approach in terms of, you know, if you're not going to get a lot of the benefits out of any of these server virtualization platforms unless you have shared storage. So if you don't have a SAN now, you're going to end up with one way or another. Figuring out what your growth curve is likely to be like, how much storage you're actually sitting on now. I mean, in addition to looking at processor utilization and networking and disk throughput, I mean, obviously storage is a big thing there too. How easy it is to grow that storage infrastructure. Ideally, you would want to have that single infrastructure, obviously, it would be a single device in most cases. Be able to scale, not infinitely, obviously, but scale through its life. Through as long as you're going to have that, you want to be able to have that grow so you don't have to have separate SANs and, you know, separate things out, unless you're large enough to really need to do that, which is, you know, there's obviously a great point there. So.
Well, to pull that out of the hypothetical, like, I mean, in the real world, what hardware are you using? What do you actually look?
Lately, we've mostly been using HPC class blades, especially in looking at that. Even in smaller organizations that don't need, or that you wouldn't think of needing a blade architecture in terms of maybe they are going to require 3 VMware hosts to run their server load. Most people wouldn't go out and assume that they need to get a blade blade chassis for that, especially because you're probably only going to half build up. One of the things we're seeing coming along the horizon and into reality, even in the small business space, probably over the last 6 months or so, but really starting to reach a percento now, is virtual desktops. And when you're talking about virtual desktops, your organization may have 20 or 30 servers, but if you have 20 or 30 servers, you probably have at least 200 to 300 employees, maybe more, maybe less. If you're actually looking at virtualizing those too, or if you decide you want to do that later, the number of blades you have to be able to, or the number of hosts you're going to need to host that is going to probably, multiply by 5 or 10. So plan on having a lot of these because this works really well for servers, but it also works really well for desktops, just in terms of power consumption. Taking that one organization that has 650 desktops, if they went to virtualization, they'd save 50K a year just in power. And they can make press releases and tout the fact that they're being very green at the same time. It's great PR. So that's the sort of thing to be thinking about. Like I said, in terms of storage, in terms of the server hardware also, looking at the long haul in terms of, for as long as I can have these servers, am I going to suddenly say that first we need 3, but now we need 25 or 30? So be thinking about that. And it's not just an issue of, having enough rack space, because most people here that are moving from a physical environment to a virtual environment are, may have 6 cabinets and now are going to need like half of one afterward. So it's not that you don't have the space, but in terms of power consumption and just management of that hardware, that's something to really think about. So blade architectures, even at the bottom end, are really where we've been going, except at the, sub 20 VM level where you just can't justify it. But that's mostly what we're doing.
Adam, any thoughts on that?
We're pretty specific in our architecture internally. We're not a big fan of NAS. We always go SAN. NASs were not developed for performance. They're developed to be cheaper than SAN. Mm-hmm. No one puts a NAS in because it's the top performing device. We put it in because it saves the money over putting in a fiber channel infrastructure and SAN. We went down the SAN route for ourselves and for most of our customers for a couple reasons. One, they're less susceptible to denial of service. It's much harder to write a sniffer for a fiber channel interface than it is for an Ethernet interface. It's much harder to put a denial of service attack on the back end infrastructure. So you have some security benefit there. On the SAN side, you also instantly get that clustering architecture set up. So if you can do clustering file systems, now you can have your entire front end talk to some large stores on the back end. It makes migration VMs very, very fast and very efficient. From there, we moved down the stack to our hardware infrastructure for the front end. We decided to go all blades for ourselves, mostly because of space. We have fairly tight quarters in our rack infrastructure, so moving into a blade infrastructure gave us a couple of things. It meant that we didn't have to manage the front end hardware anymore, or didn't have to be fairly concerned about it. We would boot from SAN, the multipath boot from SAN fiber channel, and for us to set up a new DOM zero in our infrastructure, we simply take a spare SAN volume that we have, do a snapshot, copy it to a new space, and assign it to a fiber channel card and turn on the machine. Mm-hmm. And so then we've got entire DOM zero built that you rename the host, you assign an IP address to it, and you're finished. So it's a minute, 2 minutes, up to 5 minutes to have a new physical server infrastructure tied into your backend. From there, we looked at our clustering file systems. We decided not to do OCFS2 for, I don't want to go too far down the technical side, but we decided not to go down that route. We went with the Veritas cluster file system, had a longer history, and was better supported in the Linux environment. And God forbid we ever had to add a Windows machine, and we did read that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then our front end of all that was all managed using the Xen orchestrator stack. So for us, the hardware was very, very important for our infrastructure and our architecture so that we could quickly get things up, not have to spend a ton of time on too many options. You know, I didn't want to investigate how to do the iSCSI, whether you do hardware or software or any of those pieces. Fiber channel was by far the easiest to get up and running, fastest for us to implement, and blades gave us the quick and simple, you know, you lose a blade, you move the virtual machines off, you know, with the management tool, you yank the blade out, you put a new blade in, you make sure the volume is assigned to it again, you're done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very fast for us to manage even large infrastructures without a lot of downtime, a lot of issues.
And Vincent, what did you choose?
Well, funny enough, the exact opposite.
Yeah.
We actually went off the SAN, we threw out our fiber channel. The reason for that was by the time the plane very fast was built. Mm-hmm. By the time we were hooking some big Sun servers up, the build for Veritas was knocking and just starting to get too hot for what we were getting. So we replaced our storage and went with network appliance. The reason we picked network appliance was I really liked their snap mirror capabilities, snap manager for Oracle and for SQL Server and Exchange, those sorts of things. So we bought it basically through the software. We're using totally iSCSI. On the server side, didn't like blades. The reason I didn't like blades was because of the ratio of processing power to memory that we like to go with. And I couldn't get that in blade. So again, it comes back to software licensing. We buy only quad processor servers, and that's because some software vendors will license their software by socket.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they license by core, you typically get a price break on cores 3 and 4. So a dual core, they look at as one CPU, a quad core, they typically look at as maybe 1.5. So the servers that we're buying right now are all the Dell 2950s. We picked them with two quad-core processors. That gives us a lot of processing power. We have been buying them with 32 gig of RAM. If I had my choice, I would buy them with 64 gig of RAM. And again, everybody's different. You need to look at these sort of your footprint of your own applications. But I think two quad cores running at about 3 gig with about 64 gig of RAM is a great building block for virtualization. You'll find that the processors are so powerful that you really wish you had more memory. The other thing that we did was we looked at the NIC cards that we put into the servers, and we actually buy a lot more NIC cards. We put the communication between the server and the storage just for
Yeah, I mean, I think it's up to the customer. I mean, I kind of tend to agree with Vincent that blades can be challenging, especially if people want to use iSCSI, and especially if the SME, there's a lot of folks that want to use iSCSI. Blades tend to only give you the option of two NICs, and most people only have one GIG environment, so you're just not going to be able to max out the throughput if you have high Ethernet driving applications and iSCSI. So recommended, I think, is what we're seeing a lot of customers deploying exclusively, certainly, but it's running a lot. We're starting to see a lot more iSCSI out there. So the early customers was more like two-thirds fiber channel, one-third iSCSI, I think we're starting to see that flipped. I think that's partially what Vincent's saying. There's a lot of really great technology out there today. It's easy to scale your iSCSI environment. It's certainly cheaper to scale your iSCSI environment. And I would definitely encourage you to look at the storage infrastructure, particularly around the business continuity front. So backups, HA and DR. And that's the reason why people are pulling network-based storage in virtual environments in the first place. Make sure you've kind of taken the time to think through what is your backup strategy, what is your DR strategy.
I'll hang up on Dan a little bit. So we made the same decision that Vincent made for a lot of the same reasons. I mean, obviously we have a very large, global set of data centers, and it's not to say that the majority of it, isn't sand and isn't blades, but quite a lot of that. But when it comes to really a true virtualized environment, we went with network attached storage because we just felt that the survey of data from a file system standpoint and have that kind of portability was really important to us, especially if we wanted to be portable between data centers and so forth. So we thought that was better. Secondly, it was cheaper for us and more uniform because standardization is the key to making much of this work in general. So we said, look, if I can go all IP based and VLANing, both with my storage and I don't have to maintain a separate SAN, fabric network, that's good for us too. So that simplifies the environment. And on the system side, we made a decision to a policy decision that if you consumer either internally or externally, you want compute power, you will get, an OS. Right? You'll get compute power, and whether it's on a virtual machine or not, is not really gonna be important to you other than we'll have to guarantee some sort of level of performance to get exchanged with DBs because you have to make a call. But other than that, that's policy. So we say, okay, the policy is we dish these out as OSs, and we have variable compute, so we want to be able to vary the amount of compute capacity, and then based on the applications, we have to go back and say, okay, what do we want to do? Standardization, okay, let's pick some standard building blocks. C-class blades, a little bit on the very low end, DL series HP stuff on the Windows and Linux side, and then we looked at on the Sun side, Niagara for whatever we can, because the price point is great, and we want to stay away from the larger blocks as much as possible, because the price point really goes up very quickly, even to 490 class and the new M class. IBM P series 550s, and just try to stay in four socket land, and also the memory issue, which you brought up, Vincent. I mean, we want to, because we want to be able to move things around a lot and optimize and grow, I don't want to move around too much. I don't want to environment with stuff pinging around all the time. I really want to grow stuff in place to a certain extent. And so having a four socket dual core box with 64 gig plenty of memory, I can grow that up. Plus another driver in addition to that was, we don't want to manage memory and compute capacity separately. Life is already too complicated. So we just said, look, we'll take a slice of compute and we're going to assign 512 to that, and that's what it is, right? So we're gonna manage those as a pair, and sometimes we're going to have to increase the amount of allocated resources to an application because it's running out of memory, or maybe we're going to allocate it because it's running out of compute power, but we're not going to try to manage it separately. So again, memory became very important that we had that kind of capability.
And one other thing I'd say, especially when we're talking about iSCSI and NAS, is just to make very certain that when you're looking at a storage device, just because it supports iSCSI does not mean that it's a SAN. It doesn't mean you want to use it. There's a big difference between a highly redundant hardware-based solution that uses iSCSI as its storage and basically what it's really a server, which is a single point of failure with a couple of trace disks attached to it. And I won't name vendors, but there are those that exist, and they're cheap, and they're cheap for a reason. So be careful about that. iSCSI is a great technology, but the hardware is not great. You have to be really careful about what you choose, because especially if you're talking about a system where you're going to have a single
hardware device if you're small enough, or a stack of hardware devices that are going to provide your storage for you. If that goes, you're not doing anything. It doesn't just mean that, you know, some of your data is available. It means that your VM will not run. So that is a very critical choice. So you want to pick something that has a very good track record for reliability and push a lot of data through. And that when you scale it, it doesn't just scale. This is one of the problems with most fiber channel vendors, is that as you scale your storage and increase the amount of storage that you have, you might not necessarily be adding any throughput. So if you have a 2 or 4 gig, head storage processor on your SAN, and you start adding, you know, 5, 6, 7 trays to it, you've still got that 2 or 4 gigabit of throughput. So, you know, choosing a platform that can scale the throughput as well, which is one benefit for most iSCSI platforms, is that that's how they work, is also something you want to spend some time thinking about. And in terms of Blades and iSCSI, you'll find that a lot of the Blade platforms, whether it's the Sun 6000 series, HPC classes, can drive up to 8 megs. So, that's less of an issue than it was. I think the Dells can do maybe 2 or 4. So that's something we haven't been using. But our basic building block, again, for a smaller environment is a dual socket quad core box with maybe up to 32 or 48 gigs of RAM. Memory constraints are usually the first thing that does happen in a smaller environment. You can start with less RAM and then add more as you go. But usually, the topping out at 64, which is what most platforms are maxing at these days anyway, but the dual quad platform has worked relatively well. The other thing we haven't really touched upon is what you actually use for that network hardware. Again, if you're using iSCSI, if you have one switch, you take that switch away, not only can you not get to the machines, but the machines can't get to their storage. So making your network be extremely redundant in terms of having dual cores for everything. So every one of your machines is connected to 2 different switches. If you can stack them, that's great. But just make sure that you can really go over and hang the power out of your one of your switches and nobody notices. If it doesn't pass that test, then you're running a real risk.
Another thing in terms of hardware selection is the longevity of the components in that hardware.
Mm-hmm.
You can very easily find yourself in a position where you buy a couple of Blades or a couple of servers running an Intel, whatever. 6 to 8 months down the line, you need to add more servers to that pile, and you may have a hard time finding those exact CPUs again. Specifically, if you buy the lowest end of whatever's available at the time, those get aged out. So if you buy 1.6 gigahertz quad cores now, and they're gone in 8 months, or at least difficult to find, and you wind up with a situation where you may or may not be able to add the newer processors into the same pool, and you wind up with a split infrastructure. That can also happen when you do a proof of concept. You wind up buying a couple of boxes. When you go to do the real thing, those boxes are going to have to do something else because they just won't be able to play with the invoice, so to speak.
May not be so bad though. So certainly, you want to try to aim for a plug-and-play data center, but really kind of mixing and matching those two processor styles kind of only means you can maybe lose some of the benefits of the higher end. You still might be able to kind of push them together, you just might not get some of the
benefits. Yeah, basically you can run into situations where, like, the live migration from a vMotion can occur from one box to another because of processing capabilities.
Yes, processor speed is not a big deal at all. It's just you kind of lose some parity among the cluster if you're mixing processes of different speeds. But obviously, processor manufacturer from Intel to AMD, and within those, that's really the processor instruction set that you're dealing with. Right. So what we tell people to do is just buy. You absolutely have to buy the newest processor series that exists. So that just makes sense. If you're doing a prototype environment or building out slowly, then you can buy slower ones, but just make sure that processor series, in terms of its instruction set, is going to exist throughout the time that you're going to add to that cluster, and then 3 or 4 years, whenever your server rotation time is, and you buy an entirely new one, that cluster you had built either comes out of production or moves off to more of a test bed environment than you expect to be by the weekend. So what we've seen a lot of our small business clients do is just lease the servers for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, we used to do this when
and you can do that now, and you can keep the machine around forever, which is actually one of the up and downsides of virtualization, is that your NG4 box that you have now, you could have for the next 10 years if you don't be careful. So, you know, that is, keep an eye on that. Obviously, you want to have some separate policies. But the point is, you have the flexibility to make those separate policies when you didn't before. So.
These are also, some of the issues you guys are talking about are largely specific full virtualized environments. You know, that upper end memory piece is not something we run into because we're running pair virtualization for, you know, 99% of our infrastructure. So as you start to look at these things, your infrastructure is critical to understand in the hardware and in the software decisions you make. The big ones that I looked at was pair virtualization. For us, you know, a couple of core, a couple quad core processors on a blade, we never hit, 16 or 32 gigs on a box. We run out of processing speed long before we run out of memory.
Well, it goes back to applications.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, for us, it doesn't matter whether we're virtualizing SAP or other things. The memory wasn't the issue. It was always what we're doing on the processing end of things. And then on the second piece of that is on sort of the major how to plan that architecture. You guys are right in flexibility of storage. I mean, that's critical to have something that can virtualize the storage space, that can chop it up, that can replicate it, that can snapshot it. And I don't think enough of the SAN vendors are out there doing a great job of that. And that is something that certainly needs to change. And we went down the compellent route for that specifically because they did a lot of those functions that a NAS does today, but still gave us the flexibility and the speed and the connectivity that we can.
One thing I want to touch on before we get too far away from the hardware level are things now and in the future related specifically to local storage on a per host basis, which is a problem virtual miners have never had. And I'm speaking directly here of, what if I'm going to have 8 VMware virtual iron servers, what do they have for local disk? How much going to be able to speed SAS, which is SATA in the whole nine yards. And my personal viewpoint is it's going to become a non-issue in the not too distant future, but that's not today. And I specifically want to talk about the way the virtual iron enables us, because you don't care. You don't have it, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. We have a completely embedded architecture. So the benefit behind that is, it becomes completely plug and play. So your data center is the way you kind of call it warranty, which is you slide the rack in, you turn it on, and you're ready to start adding VMs to that physical server.
Get a little deeper into that.
Sure. Yeah, so the notion here is that you install one thing, which is your management console, and there's a 28 megabyte basically compressed image that gets shuttled down to your physical servers over the network. And it's basically the same image that you would be moving off of disk if you're talking about a regular, using the alternatives like what Paul was mentioning, like VMware. But we kind of skinny it down so that it's really only the subset of functionality that you really need in order to do virtualization. Some of the benefits behind this is not only that it's plug and play, but it's a much smaller footprint in your physical server, so it's less software for us to maintain, which is goodness because it's less issues that can probably pop up in the field, and just a lot easier for one. So updates now become as easy as rebooting a physical server. Certainly using things like live migration and move VMs off of it. You don't ever need to put physical hands on that server any longer. So for example, I have a little demo rig, and I just use a network power supply to reboot servers whenever I'm installing the build of the day, for example. So much simpler model. I think you're right, Paul. That's kind of you certainly see that's the way the industry's going. You see VMware with their 3i that they've announced, and certainly a lot of hardware vendors talking about the whole notion of flash embeddable virtualization, which I think is a really good choice for SMEs. As SMEs scale up, though, this whole notion of network bootable, like what virtual iron's done, I think becomes much more interesting because the update management and the initial deployments, just doing that on the network is really awesome.
Yeah, the V3i the VMware, I'm actually kind of surprised that they didn't take that same route because it is essentially the same thing. Except with V3i, you bring it to a flash drive or to a flash drive with that image on it, just boot off that. Some has CF cards on most of their servers and their dependent latency. You can do the same thing, but you're still taking that server apart to replace or update it and drop another one in. So I'm actually kind of surprised that the V3, I mean, you knew they should be heading in that direction anyway because it removes a significant amount of overhead. But the method is actually kind of surprising. But seeing as we're in the present and let's say, for the sake of argument, we're not using virtual iron, so we need to worry about the disk on the servers. Just SAS and A.
It's not that bad. As long as you're not actually having VMs on the local disk, which is the whole point of having SAN. If you're doing a large server virtualization, and like I said before, that SAN is absolutely required for doing it. It's just, you should count it, unless you've got like five servers that you need to turn into VMs, you're going to need shared storage or you're going to launch it. So the local disk, really all it's there for is booting the server. And in the case of SAN, you can actually boot out code. That's the nice thing about 3i or virtual iron, is you basically skip $800 per host, and you have two less spinning components in the box.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're going to want, if you do need local storage, you're going to want it to be rated to the point of machine die because one disk failed. That's just kind of a no-brainer. But yeah, they don't need anything special. There are some options actually in VI35 or in they have an option where you can actually have the page files of the VMs live on local storage if you don't want to take up space on the SAN for it. So, and there are some cases where you want to use that. Most cases we haven't been. So, in that case, if you were going to do that, for if you have a reason to do that, you want to have fast local storage because of that. But for the most part, it doesn't matter.
And another thing that in the article that just printed today, I talked about this a little. And I have absolutely no hard facts to back this up, but it was a postulate at the end of that the piece just to clarify. Or facts for 98%. It seems to me that we're going to start seeing server manufacturers making discless boxes, and I mean like as a high volume commodity server. Because it changes the entire footprint of a server. You take the disk out, I don't care what the disk is, if it's SATs, it's SATA, it's a 2.5, it's a 3.5. SCSI, it just doesn't matter. If you remove the need for the power for that, you remove the need for a RAID card, either embedded or on a mezzanine or whatever, and you remove the heat load generated by those disks, everything changes. Everything in that server changes. The footprint, everything changes, and you wind up with less power, less heat. Of course, the downside is you have no local disk. But in a virtualization environment, any of the leading packages right now, now 3i is out there, can exist that way. And that is, I think, going to be a large market.
And you're already starting to see that. I think, again, just talking about the C class, you can order a blade that has no disk by Steam at all.
Right.
So that just has disk memory network and has no disk. There's nowhere you can put one if you wanted to.
Right.
As a very large purchaser of gear, right, many hundreds of millions of dollars a year, we put lots of pressure on server vendors to say that amongst other things, to say, look, we need to get for diskless. For us, everything lives back on storage, mm-hmm. right? The compute slice, we're much more concerned about storage than we are in data mobility and management than we are on servers and hypervisors. I mean, deal with it, it's important, but we're looking across Unix and all that other stuff. Everything lives back, and we will not put anything local on a server almost by absolute mandated policy because it increases the complexity and very, very difficult. So, I think disk-less compute stations and all that is definitely where you want to head in the future. Because
I think we could probably sit here until tomorrow talking about hardware and all this stuff, but we're starting to run out of time, and I do want to get to some of the other things, because this is planning and deployment. So we've done an awful lot of planning, and now we have our infrastructure in place, at least what we're going to move to. So now we actually need to do it, and that brings up the question of, as I said earlier, this can be like a spring cleaning type of thing where you just rebuild every box, which in some infrastructures might be possible. It might actually be the best way to do it. Others, it might not be. This is where the PDB tools come in. This is where all of these things happen. So I'd like to, I'll just throw this one up. Tell me what it's been like. And what choices have you made in various scenarios?
Cool. One thing we did is we looked at the problem. We had all this historical artifacts of how networks were designed, naming conventions for hosts and all of this. And in most cases, we looked at it and said, going in and like redoing all that was just going to be really difficult, very expensive, highly disruptive, rather than say, okay, we need to create an island of a newly architected environment that has all the properties that we're kind of talking about up here, do that in the right way, and of course mandate that all new things get deployed per policy in this environment that way. So that's one thing that's going to run. And then how do we move things? Now there's some virtualization you can do in the existing environment, but ultimately you want to get out of legacy land as quickly as possible. So really try to build the right thing. So in other words, let's not do the 40% solution, hoping to do 80% in a year and a half, and in 5 years maybe equal 100, maybe. Let's just do the right thing here, set the policy, move new gear, move the other stuff in there, and that way we have something that's scalable and works, that we're not constantly tagging all these legacy problems along with the time.
Actually, Vincent, how did you approach that problem?
We were kind of in a unique situation. We were at the beginning of the year talking about moving our data center. It was currently on the 10th floor where our corporate headquarters are. We are a software as a service provider, so we are both application availability and scalability is something that's extremely important for us. So we're moving into a concrete facility. We started by looking at the ES route, and we decided to go our own way. We went into a co-location facility. At that point, then we decided that we were going to do a complete hardware refresh. Once we decided we were doing a hardware refresh, we said, well, now let's look at the infrastructure architecture as well. And that's when we decided to go to VMware. So we actually moved from being a Sun shop for 5 years. Now, our databases are pulling on an IBM P570. All of our middle tier applications are on Dell using VMware. And all of our storage went from SAN to NAS. So we did it, certainly wouldn't say by the book, because we were really pressured to get the data sent out. We did just enough testing. As far as I was listening to you all talk about how many size and how many blocks to buy, and we didn't use the S, to be honest with you.
That might work.
Yeah. Something like that. And because of the nature of what we do, I wanted at least double the capacity anyway. So I find that I was quite happy to end up with 3 or 4 times rather than half of what I needed. So it actually came out okay. But we did take sort of a clean sheet approach. The benefit, that was the good part of it. The bad part of it was we had to do it very quickly. I think one of the things that we were fortunate in was that our applications all scale out. So I think knowing how your applications scale, if you scale up or scale out, is very important. So we were able to make some basic decisions about going to very fine-grained VMs, some basic separation for licensing costs, and really creating a sort of a clean sheet of paper. We were actually very pleased with the results that we've had so far.
Yeah, one of the things I'd throw in there when you're talking about DB tools and whether or not to rebuild, if you're talking about a Windows environment, this really does pretty much only apply to Windows. If it's an old install, meaning it's more than 2 or 3 years, probably you should consider rebuilding it, whether you do it before or after your migration to, if you've got outside concerns that maybe you really need to get this virtualization done, so with the tools, maybe if you're having all the problems, you're going to bring some with you when you do the migration. You're going to get rid of all your hardware problems, but you're also going to bring along, you know, you've got a 4 or 5 year old Windows installation that's going to have all the standard Windows rot that Windows gets. So, you know, that's, you know, rebuilding those is a good idea whether or not you do it right away or not. I definitely have seen situations where we've migrated a bunch of Windows boxes from older hardware to, you know, virtualized, you know, brand new hardware. And almost everything works perfectly with the exception of one box that inexplicably runs slower after it's been virtualized than it did before putting on crappy hardware to begin with. And it's that sort of thing where, you know, you rebuild that, with, you know, install 2003 or deploy to an image or whatever, and then reinstall the application, and that problem just doesn't exist. And the only thing I can say is to attribute it to Windows being weird. But you do have to keep an eye on that. Don't just assume that you can press go on your BDB tool and have everything work great, because that won't always be the case. So if you're planning your timetable based on using a, you know, BDB tool and it's going to take you, you know, half an hour or 15 minutes a server to migrate it, that's not a good plan. There are going to be, you know, there are going to be things you're going to need to rebuild, and you may just want to plan on doing it if you're the size that can do it. If you've got 2,000 machines you're moving, you can't rebuild all of them, probably. But that's, you know, definitely back to what Frank said in terms of taking the opportunity to clean up the environment that you're running your software on, build some standards in terms of patching and all of that sort of stuff that really doesn't have anything to do with virtualization per se, but this is the time when you're making all these changes that you get to bring all of those other things into focus. And it, you know, it, just as a side note, this is also a great time to start, if you don't do chargeback billing and you've got a bunch of departmental servers, great time to do that, because it goes from, you know, being able, you know, saying, okay, we're gonna, you want $7,000 server, so we're going to make it get $7,000 for it, you're going to be able to install it. Once you start slicing things up into compute cycles, and you're going to say, this machine gets this much processing power, then that's a great time for you to figure out what that costs, tell the user that they pay you for it. One of the problems is somebody can walk into your office and say, we need a VM, but then it's like, you can get it to them. That's great. It's really not great. I would avoid telling anybody that.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, there needs to be accountability both in terms of who's paying for it and, you know, making sure you don't overburden your environment without taking in, you know, without budgeting for that, which is off the top of
a quick comment to that. I mean, this is kind of back to, you know, what do you do, try to migrate inside of it or try to do a greenfield. One of the things we found very effective is when you switch to a cost model, which is, you know, we haven't really talked too much about, but I think that's, you know, a critical point of moving forward, because
that's our approach.
Yeah, so getting into the cost model is very important. But what you can use that as is you say, deploy in a new way, conform, standardize, new world, it costs X. If you want anything outside of that, and even if it's still there, guess what? It's 2x, right? And then you dump that on the business unit or whoever to bear the cost. And they're, you know, they're complaining about, you know, why they need special treatment, kind of tends to go away very, very quickly. So it's a great tool for P2B.
Just to add on too, I mean, I think a lot of the things we've been talking about, you need to go through what are the existing systems and processes you have in place to manage your physical servers. So, interesting anecdote. I was at a large conglomerate in Connecticut, and the way they were managing kind of their what applications run on the server is they have little plastic ID tags, and that's probably not going to work in your virtual environment. 15 of them and 3 SAs, they're going to go, you know, as you're live migrating around. So think through kind of, you know, what are the systems you're going to have in place to kind of keep track, kind of a nice ping example we had before the session, of where your virtual machines are. You know, you're not just going to be doing PDBs, you're going to be actually creating new infrastructure as well, and that's actually going to probably, you know, be the driver of the most significant growth in your virtual environment. So, you know, are you using configuration management databases to data track the patches you're adding? What's the accountability? We talked about chargeback, but what's the accountability for actually, you know, creating new virtual machines, and when do they actually go away? Should they go away, especially in depth tests? So, you know, how do you actually put those sorts of processes in place? And we have some interesting customer anecdotes, just to think about, especially on the dev test, because those folks really like to ask for servers and never get them back. We have one financial services customer that basically kind of operates almost kind of like a library model where you know, the virtual machine it comes up for renewal on a periodic basis, so they have to, you know, justify why that virtual machine should stay in existence. And if nobody cost justifies it, it's archived. And the great thing about virtual infrastructure, as you guys probably already know, is through kind of those sorts of things as you're thinking through your deployments as well.
I've always been a big fan of determining whether or not a server actually needs to remain in existence by pulling Ethernet.
Yeah.
3 weeks later, you get an email. Like, you know what? Maybe that one really doesn't need to be there anymore. And this is too major. Pause or stop and so forth, and you're exactly right. So in terms of handling these migrations, I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of doing the rebuild again if it's at all possible, especially on Linux boxes, because they tend to be easier to move applications and such on Linux than it is on Windows, especially if there were no notes taken during the initial application installation on the Windows boxes, because you wind up with
That's actually something I build on. Again, this doesn't have anything to do with virtualization, but in a couple of instances, we've said, okay, well, we really want to rebuild all of your machines, say they've got 31, and you know the main components, things like that, exchange servers even, are pretty easy to do that, but you just install the software and migrate the data around, and you're good to go. And you always usually get pushback on that for one or two machines that have some application that are over. Why is it? Does it take a long time to rebuild? Okay, you know, that's a problem. If you don't have the internal knowledge of how to rebuild the machine you have, that's a liability no matter where you're running it. So this is a good time to, you know, rip the band-aid off quickly and sit down and figure out how to do all of these things, how to rebuild those machines, and then document them. And if you don't have good documentation procedures now, you need to have them while you're doing this. And it's a great time to do that, because if you're going back around and rebuilding everything, that's a great time to have that all documented and keep it up after that. So the concept of virtualization, you can replicate exactly what you have in terms of policies and in terms of all the problems you have in policies now. It's an excellent time to actually take the time to fix those.
It's also a great time to implement the configuration management database you've all been talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Windows can use the copy of diff.
Exactly. Yeah, all of that. Because that's a huge saver when, in fact, the what's out there, I don't know, which should be.
Yeah,
that is the next step to be able to, you know, broad scale.
Mm-hmm. And along those same lines, they got a pretty good anecdote in terms of where you would think like a P2B would be the only option. And it turned out to be the exact opposite. There was a situation that I was familiar with where there was a tool that was no longer, it was supported by the company that a couple versions back that half of the development staff used. It was a version control software. But the support had been let to lapse because they didn't need any of the new features of the new stuff. They were very happy with the version that they were using. However, licensing was bound with a MAC address on one physical box, which was running on a workstation class system, running NT4 that would no longer launch Explorer. So it made working on that box extremely interesting. God help you if the license server went down. It also took, I believe it took 28 minutes to reboot, and nobody really knew why that would be. But you're faced with a situation here where, well, it'd be easy enough, we would just get the license to, you know, move to a new MAC address, and we're doing virtualization anyway, so we'll just move to the MAC address on the VMware box and we're good to go. Except that the company that produced the software went $48,000 to regenerate the key, because you had to go up to the latest version and there was no facility for them to regenerate the other key. Well, that's an awful lot of money. You know, that's actually more than they were spending on the hardware to do the VMware migration in the first place. Surprisingly enough, building a new Windows 2003 server and doing a little fun games with the MAC address spoofing, move the license over, and we're actually able to do physical harm to that server. Because those are situations, those are things that keep you up. And what happens if that box actually dies and it's on the main board? What are we going to do about it? Okay, I think after that we're actually getting near the end of the session here. So I'll open up right now for questions. If there's anything anybody wants to ask the panel, by all means, stick a hand up and we'll get a microphone to you over here. Oh, we got two. Okay. Okay, we got three. Can I get four? Three. get four, I get four, I get five. Seven, do I see seven?
There you go, sir.
So I just wanted to find out if what your opinion on tow cars are for use in storage. So
On what now?
Tow cars.
Oh, okay.
Tow cars.
TCPL.
Great that the virtualization platform supports it. up until recently, VMware, as an example, didn't. So, that's something you have to be careful about, because you could go spend extra money buying them and not be able to use them. But in general, if you have the ability to support them in terms of the software, then by all means, get some processing power off your core CPUs and make things faster to build. So, especially when you're talking about iSCSI, not having that support in whatever stack is doing iSCSI, whether it's a software or hardware stack, it's important. That builds on what you're talking about, a second or more of actual throughput. That makes a big difference. Also, flow control, general framing, big things to look at there too, in terms of being able to support that. So.
That software is making hardware virtual. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that we can have behavioral model, functional model, all those things in VLM, we can have some of embedding?
I'm sorry, I haven't heard that here.
UML for designing software, mm-hmm. Can we have some notations like that, model embedding like that for virtualization?
I guess what you're asking about is some sort of modeling language to model out the virtual machine and
yes.
The rest of the infrastructure. And I think a lot of the, that's probably what some of the planning process here we're talking about would be doing. I don't know if there's a software package out there that kind of would take all your inputs and just come up with a schematic, but I think it's an interesting direction. I know that certainly from a higher level management perspective, I'm trying to manage your data center environment. That's where a lot of the DNPF folks want to get to. But I'm not sure there's anything on the market today.
Yeah. So much of virtualization is about movement. So you're going to model out this infrastructure and what it looks like to start, and you're going to put it on the board, and then you're going to put it into production, and exactly 8 minutes later, things are going to start moving. Because of resources, because of load, because of new services that you want to spin up. And we gave our developers the ability to provision their own test environments and stations. They went nuts.
Yeah, I mean, that's brave.
They went nuts. They were like, oh, we're doing a project for this client, this client, this client. And all of a sudden, it's like, I turn around and they get 100 VMs in their little corner. And I'm like, guys, you got to slow down. You're killing us. So you got to look at, when you start looking at modeling, if you really have to look at it from a resources perspective more so than anything else, and that has to be fluid. It's got to be changeable. That's the whole point of virtualization.
Great. I'll take another question.
So it's a common thing to hear, doing everything but Exchange and SQL, or everything but Exchange in a database. Other than just being conservative, what's the technical reason for not virtualizing those things?
Okay. Truthfully, there isn't one. I've virtualized Exchange and SQL tons of times. There's no reason. If you do a Google for this on the internet, you're going to find a lot of people who blog and say, never put SQL on a VM because it won't work. That's not true. The thing you do have to look at is both SQL, if it's highly transactional and you're pushing a lot of data through it, and Exchange, even if it doesn't really seem like you're using it very much, will create a lot of disk I/O. And disk I/O is one of the things that you do take an overhead. Well, you take an overhead on anything that's virtualized, but specifically storage is a big one. You have to watch out for that. So, for example, I've got one environment that has about 1,600 light users that are running on two Exchange VMs. Absolutely no problem. If I had 9,000, it would really not be worth virtualizing. So, where that breakpoint is, you have to sit down and figure out what your storage can actually provide through a VM, and that really requires some real-life testing of put a VM on the server hardware you're going to use with the storage hardware you're going to use and see what you can actually get out of it. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do that with a platform that we use a lot to determine what will work and what won't work. But the idea that it will not work is
starting there is not a good idea. Ending up there is well within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, once you have the experience and the know-how for the environment, you know the loads.
And you can monitor, right? Be able to monitor your storage IO and that sort of thing, so you can be proactively being careful. If you throw out and then something goes wrong, it hits you reactively. It's very difficult.
Depending on the product you're using, there's finite limitations on how big a virtual machine can be. And VMware, I think, it's 4 cores and 32 gig of RAM. So that's what we look at, is if a particular instance of a server needs more than 4 cores or 32 gig of RAM, obviously it's not a candidate, but it's not a single server per se or exchange per se that you don't want to virtualize. It's just you need more horsepower than you can get out of a single VM.
Right. And you're going to see those named SQL Exchange thrown around as a good examples. So that it's not specific.
And anything highly transactional and heavy IO is going to fall.
Yeah, and you could have MySQL server that isn't a good idea because of that. So because of that.
We have another one?
Yep.
For the panelists who have been doing chargebacks for your services, could you comment on before virtualization and after virtualization, what has changed in your, say, your formula for chargeback?
So what the major change is where typically you were just doing more CapEx, so people buying gear, and you say, okay, these servers and storage for you, and they put over some sort of 3 years depreciation or whatever, internally or to customers. Now, like I mentioned before, we just abstracted all the gear away, so you're gonna buy X amount of compute, Y amount of storage, and that was the major change, right? So part of it was us modeling the price, so a certain segment of compute with memory costs X dollars, and then there's a system fee that picks up incident management, monitoring, all those things, so there's a fix and there's a variable depending on how much horsepower. And getting that to the network and the storage, all the pieces wrapped together, and then forcing them by policy to never ask for a physical server again, that was the major change. But once we got there, of course, the business units on the financial side loved it, predictable, scaled with pricing. They say, that's fantastic, we could use this anti-legacy policy to say, if you want it the old way, it's twice as expensive. Or even on the developer side, like you're talking about, it's just like, you want hundreds of VM? Okay, here's your charge per VM. Every time you hit that button, your finance guy is going to get another line on it, so that slows them down a little bit too. But that's the main change. It's just getting them, trying to abstract the costing away from specific physical gear.
And I think jumping off on that, I've actually seen several companies that were fortunate or unfortunate enough to have a large development team actually use the requirements of the new project to virtualize their entire infrastructure, because the developers come up and say, hey, we need 47 new boxes all running SQL 2005. This and that and the other thing. And you hand them a line item and it gets approved and you buy everything you need to turn your entire infrastructure into VMware or virtual environment right from that one thing. And they don't know anything, because they think they need 47 boxes running nothing, because it all lines up in a sandbox. And the funny part is, everybody's happy. I never quite understood how that works.
They might ask your upgrade.
Yeah. As long as you make sure to hide the VMware tools tray icon or whatever.
That's one thing we haven't even mentioned, is that there are companies that are still out there that you mentioned that machine's a VM and they will almost hang up the phone on you. So careful when you're doing this, make sure you don't necessarily have to put them into the position where they say that we'll use support if we virtualize it. You usually get a peremptory no from that, just because they don't want to be responsible for the architecture you're setting up, just as though they're not responsible for the hardware you have now. But there are companies that we run into, mostly in the healthcare sector, that if you, when you call them, you call up and say, it's a VM, we can't help you, sorry. And we'll almost hang up the phone, I think. But those same people, you hang up and call back and be like, I've got this machine that's doing this. Oh, what is it? Oh, it's a 2 gigahertz, it's 1.4, blah, 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 blah. And then they'll help you and everything works fine. So, but if you have any of those software vendors, especially if they're very important, that may be that set for a sad reason. And I think we'll change over time.
Well, let's hope they get into the 21st century.
We'll do one more question. I need a little truth in advertising. I'm sorry I'm coming at the end here, but you guys are describing radically different compute environments. I think one was a developer environment, one was an application for a Fortune 2000 type company. You're describing medical companies. I mean,
Let's
are there some general rules of thumb that say a typical $100,000 company with running all its accounting applications is going to be ideal for virtualization versus a company that's doing an online auction in a next generation virtual environment would probably not be a candidate? I mean, we need to get some sort of level set in terms of, you know, where you guys are in terms of the kind of things you're doing.
I think it's highly dependent on exactly that. If there was a rule of thumb that would apply to everybody, it would be wonderful. It isn't. We're trying to give examples of varying types of infrastructures, which is why, you know, we have different viewpoints on architecture from, you know, what we need all the RAM we can get versus what we don't need all the RAM we can get, we need all the cores we can get. We need the fiber channel, we don't need the fiber channel. It really is extremely dependent on what we're doing, which is why we spent a lot of time on planning trying to get an idea of what the performance needs of your physical infrastructure are before you start anything, before you move into the virtual realm, because there's no other way to tell.
The only thing I'd add to that is just to say that if you have more than 6 or 8 servers, 95 times out of 100 virtualization is going to be saving money and make your environment easier for the launch. So if you have exactly what type and how you configure it, that's going to change all the way up the spectrum.
We're providing a production, you know, SAP and AdVision and Microsoft Business and databases and this whole huge portfolio of enterprise applications out of big Fortune 50 customers. It works, it's enterprise ready. We had to do a lot of extra management tool planning to make it work at that scale. But it fundamentally isn't that different from you know, any size here. There's some fundamentals on architecture, decision making, planning, tools, getting ahead of the curve rather than being sort of reactive, consolidating, which is a lot of what's happening now. 80% of that, maybe more, we've been talking about it, that being valid everywhere. When you get into a broad, highly scalable development environment, there's tools and things you have to pay attention to. If you're like, maybe something like we're delivering SAP to a customer, you know, that's not going to be that radically dynamic. It's going to be more like they might be growing over time, or they might add something. And there's going to be some differences there. They might have higher SLA requirements than a broad developer environment. And that you've seen, I think, those variances in some of the decision making across the panel. But again, I would claim that 80-90% of the fundamentals still apply.
Yeah, I think it's if you're running the standard, if you're running Windows, you're running Linux, either or, and you have the easiest way to put it is a normal infrastructure. You're not running 5-year-old, you know, 5 IRIX boxes from that. You know, if you're a reasonably modern infrastructure, virtualization is going to work for 90 to 100% of your business needs. You know, there are definitely cases where it's not going to. They're generally related to load and/or compatibility at the OS level. So I think the rule of thumb is it's going to work. It's just a matter of figuring out how it's going to work for you and what we need to in terms of hardware and software to get that.
And even in terms of load, if your model is scaling out your charges, say virtualization makes that far easier.
And even to a certain extent, if you virtualize, now, you know, it depends. So if you're in Linux land, so Windows is obviously a little bit different, but Linux land in particular, it's very easy to flip between physical and virtual environments. Right, especially if you're, you know, from our side, where everything's on NAS mount from a file system standpoint. So if we run into issues, you know, we have full building blocks in the environment, we'll just flip it over, right? So you can also deal with unforeseen issues that way as well.
Yeah, but you can do, a dozen different ways.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I actually, there are some infrastructures that will run certain servers as virtual for most of the quarter and bounce them over to a big box.
Yeah, and there's BDP tools as well. So,
yeah.
You know, a lot of compliance and software support, which I mentioned before. You know, Microsoft stance is if you can't reproduce it in a hardware environment, that work can help you. Like, once they get to the point where they really have no idea what the answer is and don't want to talk to you anymore, that's what they'll say, which I've never had happen. But in that case, there is, you know, HP, for example, for running HP servers, you can, you know, BDP, there are other tools that will do that, just so you can reproduce the environment.
All right, we're way out of time, so I'm going to thank my panel very much for scalability, and I think that was actually a pretty good segue. But everybody go grab a bite to eat. Thanks for coming, and again, thanks.
We really very much for this. Can you please exit through the side doors? The side doors on the room, and come back in through the back doors. The line is outside. Please exit through the side doors. Also, the NEC and MTM invite only luncheon will take place at Carmel 2, just past the elevator. So please exit through the side doors and come in through the main doors with your food. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to go back. Cheers.
Yeah.
Cheers.